Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everyone, to today's episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Displacement in the News, Reporting Stories of Crisis and Migration from the Middle East. I'm pleased to be joined today by our guest, Karim Shehayeb, who is a Beirut-based journalist currently reporting for the Associated Press, where he primarily covers Lebanon and Syria. He previously reported for Al Jazeera and has reported for Sky News, The New York Times, The New Humanitarian, and other news agencies. He holds an MA in Political Economy of the Middle East from King's College, London. Welcome to the podcast, Karim.
Thanks, it's good to be here.
It's really nice to have a journalist on the podcast, and I wanted to pick up on some of the experiences that you have had as a journalist. So I wanted to get a sense from you about the practice of reporting on these issues around displacement. I wanted to start by asking you, when did you start your journalism work, and how much of it has been in sort of urban related work?
I started around, I would say it's around probably 2016 when I started entering sort of the journalism world. So several years ago, but not too long ago. But it was a very significant time, I think, for urban reporting. I was based in Lebanon, where I am right now. At the time, it was almost, it was about half a decade since a lot of the Syrian refugees started coming into Lebanon because of the uprising turned conflict there. And also Lebanon started witnessing, you know, popular protests over infrastructural issues like garbage and other things. So a lot of things about what happened in different spaces around the city, whether it was displacement or protest movements, really became the center of a lot of interesting stories in the country. And later on, of course, you had things like the economic crisis, the uprising, the Beirut port blast, and everything that came with it, like housing issues and infrastructural issues. And of course, now more than ever, you know, the refugee issue has come back to light. So a lot of my reporting has actually been centered around cities, whether it's in Beirut or Tripoli or elsewhere. It's a reflection, I think, of Lebanon as a country where all its resources are. But a lot of things have taken place in the urban. And so I find myself spending much more time there than in villages or remote areas that are more peaceful.
So you had quite an eventful 8 years working as a journalist on many of these issues. I mean, so many things have happened in this time. What are some of the different trends that you've seen in relation to displacement in rural versus urban areas? Because you cover the entire country, don't you?
Yeah, there's something to be said about the experiences of reporting on refugees in rural areas versus urban areas. Obviously, not all urban areas and rural areas are alike, right? But, you know, especially early on, a lot of the rural areas in Lebanon that were closer to the Syrian border were a little more welcoming of Syrian refugees at first. There's a lot of intermarrying, the borders are very porous. So you almost kind of saw it as like this very, you know, there's a crisis, they're going to shelter them for a little bit. There's a lot of aid coming in. Whereas in the cities, I think, you know, people are a little bit more anxious, you know, especially with a lot of parts of the cities are a little less personal than the rural. You know, rural, you have these several families and clans and so on. But then I think going forward, things became much more class and religion based more than what the space was. So, for example, you know, if you go to Tripoli or Akkar in northern Lebanon, like Tripoli is the country's second city, Akkar is the most impoverished part of the country, or if not one of the top most impoverished place in the country, there seems to be like an okay relationship given that level of camaraderie and the closeness to the northern border, the intermarriages and so on. In some Christian areas, for example, they initially were okay with hiring lots of Syrian refugees to do the labor jobs, right? Lebanon, a lot of Lebanese people don't do these kinds of, you know, work in construction, labor in agricultural fields and stuff like that. These are things that Syrian refugees did for a very long time in Lebanon, even before the conflict. But they were less patient with the growing number of Syrians residing in their areas, especially when it came to sort of like young working Syrian men, and especially as UNAIDS started to decline. In an ideal world, they would sort of show up and work and go back and be somewhere else. Obviously, with most of the refugees being Sunni, the Sunni community in northern Lebanon wasn't thinking so much about demographic shifts back in the day. The Christians were concerned about it because, you know, they are a minority in Lebanon and their numbers are dwindling, and they think about permanent displacement and how that impacts, I guess, the political geography of Lebanon, right? So the kind of conversations that the local community has about refugees is very different. The frustrations they have, some are less general than others, and so on. I think a lot of the aid started to decline when, you know, the donor fatigue kicked in and suddenly they were cutting programs and more Syrians, you know, could not just stay in their tented encampments and so on. And they had to look for work, and the economy in Lebanon started to decline. That's where people started to butt heads. And obviously, like, there's a big debate about, you know, to what extent are these criticisms of the refugees' presence in Lebanon true or not, and whether some of it's, you know, political grandstanding or not. But this became a very big conversation. And the interesting part when I started doing journalism was not long after these things were happening. Lebanon elected a president in late October 2016, Michel Aoun, who in his speech after he was voted in mentioned that we need to resolve this security risk, which is the Syrian refugees in Lebanon, a demographic and security risk. And this was, it almost sort of was a foreshadowing of the relationship that we have, Lebanon has with Syrian refugees today, I think.
There's so much that's been going on over the last several years. And as you pointed out, there's been different kinds of challenges and also changing attitudes towards refugees and so on. But also at the same time, a lot of challenges that the Lebanese themselves face, right? So I'm just wondering, like, what do you see as being some of the current issues that people are facing and that you are covering?
You know, so at the moment, the big thing is about the economy. And of course, you know, since 2019, Lebanon's economy has been spiraling. And, you know, that what comes with it, other than, of course, the collapse of the healthcare system, the electricity grid, rising child labor, and really rising poverty in a country that is generally middle income, is a mass immigration of Lebanese people. And at the same time, aid has been declining for Syrian refugees, many who don't want to go back to Syria, either for security reasons or for economic reasons as well. So all of a sudden, the whole idea about Syrians are coming into work in Lebanon, while Lebanese are leaving Lebanon to find work, became a huge part of, you know, the local discourse and so on. Even though there's, you know, there's a lot of questions about the accuracy of, about this, right? Because they do work very different jobs. And then Lebanon also as well is the reason that there's global attention on Lebanon, at least from the Europeans, is the fact that Lebanon has been used as a smuggling route into Europe. Europe and the global north in general are saying, look, Syria is not safe for return. You know, we got to keep the Syrian refugees in these next door countries, give them some aid and so on. But at the same time, the moment that large numbers of Syrian refugees leave, you know, Lebanon across the Mediterranean through extremely dangerous ships through a smuggler or whatever, and they try to, you know, they arrive in Greece or Cyprus, they sometimes try to go to Italy, that's when the Europeans really freak out about Syrian refugees. And so Lebanon responds, you know, tries to crack down on these smugglers, right? The Lebanese army, for example, gets lots of support from the US and from Europe. And so they're trying to also patrol the seas a bit more, try and stop these, you know, migrations and so on. And they're kind of struggling a bit, especially because a lot of the people who are starting to migrate a few years ago were Lebanese too, right? They're Lebanese, poor Lebanese, are trying to find jobs abroad. They're thinking, well, maybe we can go and find something. And there are Lebanese who are stuck in Cyprus and elsewhere who are just, who left mostly from northern Lebanon. And so the army for the longest time would say, okay, we stopped the smuggling ring. There's a lot of questions about who these smugglers are, right? They're not exactly people who will show up and introduce themselves and say, you know, I work an honest day's job as a smuggler, you know, times are tough, they, you know. What we do rely on, though, as journalists, is a lot of the anecdotes from Syrians who returned, who were, you know, stopped at sea, they come back, and they tell us about these smugglers, and they're extremely horrifying stories. There were times where you'd hear stories about, you know, Syrians paying a shady guy some money, and they're put on a boat, and they're left middle of the sea. These are stories that we hear from people who reported on the mass migrations from Izmir, Turkey, for example, and so on. But then there's a lot of cases of Lebanese and Syrians talking about guys who, you know, threaten them at gunpoint if they don't pay back what they owed, and a lot of, you know, almost like as if it's like this criminal network. Now, the army and the security agencies always talk about, you know, arresting these smugglers, but we don't know who they are in a lot of detail. And of course, it's a massive challenge as reporters because you know, you really want to find out what this network is and what they're linked to, but you can't. But right now, I think the center of attention in terms of Lebanon hosting refugees from Syria of an international community is the fact that many of them are leaving Lebanon, which has a very depleted army, poor funding. The army requires aid for food and fuel, you know, compared to back in the day, which was mostly about weapons and technical support. It's to try and stop this kind of smuggling. And this is something that, you know, recently, you know, Cyprus was really, you know, frustrated with it. They flew into Lebanon to try and sort out a bilateral deal. The EU came in, tried to set up a package. This is right before the Brussels conference as well. So I think the biggest challenge right now is for Europe when it comes to refugees in Lebanon is holding up all this migration going through the Mediterranean Sea, which has been driving Greece and Cyprus and Italy and Malta nuts, because they want more refugees to go to the major countries in Europe, and they feel like they're carrying that burden. And for Lebanon, really, it's trying to convince the international community to let the Syrians go back to Syria, even though there's a lot of questions over how safe it actually is. If you look at, you know, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and other reports. So it's almost as if Syrian refugees are sort of like a diplomatic pawn right now in Lebanon, because the Lebanese can't just throw them back in Syria. It will ostracize them politically. But at the same time, they can't just let them go into Europe, because that'll also ostracize them politically. So it's almost like there's all this heated rhetoric against Syrian refugees. There'll be a crackdown on refugees that don't have their papers. They'll deport some of them. They'll detain some of them. They'll let others go. And it often comes around the Brussels conference. So I think in Lebanon, this trend, I think, has gone on for like several years now. So this is sort of the trend. I think it's been like this for like 3 years right now. Every time around the Brussels conference, this whole escalation and the escalation happens. It's like a pattern almost.
It sounds almost like the Lebanese government, when they do these kind of crackdowns, they want to make the situation such that the Syrians leave on their own accord, rather than the government itself pushing people back in either direction and being held accountable for it.
There have been Syrians who have spoken to me and said that the difficulties they face in mobility, especially during these periods, you know, definitely makes them more inclined to try and go to Europe or to try and give it a shot back in Syria. There's no doubt about it. There were some Syrians I've interviewed, for example, who were sent back upon their attempt to go to Cyprus, for example, and because they're scared of going back to, you know, the security agencies to pick up their papers, now they'd get arbitrarily deported, that they decide, well, let's go back to Syria and smuggle our way out from there, or just try another way to smuggle our way out again. And I think there's been lots of talks as well from Lebanese authorities about finding ways to incentivize Syrians to leave. And a lot of them believe that if the UN aid goes into Syrian territory, that they will leave. And that's the only reason why they're staying in Lebanon. This is a narrative you hear from a growing number of senior politicians in Lebanon. You don't hear from the prime minister yet, but you certainly hear it from, you know, the foreign minister and other people as well. That, I think, shows that Lebanon's sort of in a bit of a weird place where it can talk hard line, but it can't implement it. And we're not really sure where that will go, because ultimately it's up to geopolitics and bigger actors more so than Lebanon, I think.
I was wondering, and this might be a very silly question, but what are the challenges that you face as a reporter doing these stories, and how do you get access? How do you get a story going?
I think it's such a really important question, because I mean, I think you see it as well with other stories, that sometimes you will see so many stories in a matter of in a few days over an incident, suddenly sort of fades out almost with the news cycle. And a lot of the early years, I mean, most of my journalism career, I was a freelancer, right? So a lot of the stories, even if they were, you know, on paper, very good, interesting stories, you had to really sell them to get the editor to pay you or whatever. And it depends on where it was in the news cycle or whatever. This is just the reality of the industry, or elements of the industry. You know, for example, in the first couple of years or so of the refugee situation in Lebanon, it was relatively easy. You know, you call up, you can go with an NGO, for example. They can show you the work that they're doing. And through there, you meet some Syrian families there. You get in touch with them, you know, and then you stay in touch with them and you learn more about what their life is like. And you build relationships through them, just like you do with any other people in the communities that you report in, right? Whether you're in Beirut or in Baghdad or in Berlin, right? Later on, it did get a bit tricky, right? Obviously, you would have to, of course, get permits ahead of time before you go now, when you want to go to a refugee camp, especially, you know, in some parts of the country. But I think more so than that, there's much more fear from refugees to open up and to talk about what they go through. I mean, there always was in the first place, to be honest, but they would still talk to you, or they would say, well, look, I want to share this incident with you, but can you keep that off the record? I'm scared that the guy might read it and he'll come after me for saying it or something like that. But they would still talk to you. They'd still be happy to appear on camera. But then also the context, I guess it changes. And I guess I'm just thinking out loud with you on this, because back in the day it was about adjusting to life as a refugee. For example, after spending your whole life living in your hometown or your home village, it could be about aid programs and what they look like, you know, in parts of Lebanon, which never really had this kind of presence of major NGOs and so on. Later on, it got really heavy. It got, you know, we started talking about things like security raids, especially when there was an issue with ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates in northeastern Lebanon, for example, when it got to things like discrimination, attempted informal migration, you know, deportations, right? So all of a sudden, you're talking about much, much heavier things. And so they fear reprisal much more than before. That's kind of really the biggest challenge now. There's a big fear on them speaking. Obviously, when you want to talk about these kinds of issues, there's obviously concern about, you know, what kind of access you'll get in terms of the security lens, right? Because a lot of these are rated security, you know, whether it's deportation, migration, you know, the security agencies mostly will talk to you here, for example. But, you know, over time, I think when the issues get more securitized, then it's obviously harder to access, I think. Whereas back in the day, it was a lot about their stories, you know, who they are and how they're navigating life, whether it was, you know, a Syrian farmer who moved with his, you know, relatively large family into a rural area, or a young Syrian guy who's in his early 20s, maybe is a musician or something, and is on the streets of Hamra trying to get along with some other artists and, you know, make things work for them. And I feel like those stories, outside of the global context about, you know, the migration lens and other issues, I don't think they definitely are not as prevalent. So these kinds of stories are not very commonplace anymore, I feel. But then also, I think Syrians being in the spotlight is not so common, because I think there's a security lens as well. Whenever I try to shed light on a particular story, I've had a lot of interesting stories which I couldn't go through with, because it had to be a very personal story. You have to kind of dig into these people's backgrounds and who they are, and they're just scared that this information could come back to haunt them, especially if they have plans to try and migrate or something like that. So to do a lot of these in-depth stories is I think is a little trickier than before. I mean, it's not impossible. Nothing is impossible, but it's far trickier than before, no doubt.
You've talked about a lot of different issues that you cover as a reporter, but I want to come back to that question about cities. So again, in your experience, how do you think displacement impacts cities today, based on what you've seen through your work?
Based on what I've covered when it comes to displacement in Beirut in the past, you know, several years is interesting, because I wasn't alive when Palestinian refugees moved to Lebanon and settled there and so on. You know, this was a long time ago. But I got to witness slowly over time, especially in the communities I spent most of my time with in Beirut and where I report about how these things have changed. And it's very interesting, because the transformations are all very different. And, you know, I think for everyone, they're going to say whether they think it's a good thing or a bad thing, right? What I can say, though, is that it definitely impacts every segment of society that you see. Firstly, when it comes to the labor market, you kind of see where some kinds of work, for example, becomes more present because of the kinds of skills or, you know, experience different people have, for example. From a cultural perspective, in some spaces, I mean, granted, Syria and Lebanon are very similar culturally in many, many ways. But in some spaces, for example, there was, you know, a lot of, especially early on, a lot of Syrian musicians and artists would come, and they shared spaces with a lot of Lebanese artists, and that became very interesting to kind of see how they collaborated at times, which I personally found very interesting as somebody who's very interested in music and art and this kind of thing. It was interesting to kind of see how some of the demographic shifts, because there are more residents in an area, brought back a lot of narratives that, you know, older Lebanese tell me represented some of that from the Civil War, you know, talks about the populations of people and so on, when not long ago it was mostly about corruption or politics, but then it became about demographics or whatever. You know, early on in the economic crisis, though, when the uprising happened, for example, that narrative around Syrian refugees completely went, and actually most people were talking about, you know, the banks and corruption and so on. And then after the uprising, you know, failed and bringing about a new Lebanese political reality, now a lot of the narratives about Syrian refugees having jobs while Lebanese aren't able to even, you know, stay in the country, and they're trying to find opportunities away. It transforms, I think, the local politics in the area very, very quickly, It's just very interesting how even a community that is nearby, same language, very similar food, if not almost identical, depending on where you are in Lebanon, but it changes everything, right? And of course, it's not, as a journalist, I'm not gonna say whether it's a good or bad thing, but you know, it becomes a very divisive thing. It becomes a major policy point in the country right now, because it's almost as if, you know, there is a certain balance or equilibrium a country has in terms of its economy, in terms of its population and social makeup or whatever. And then all of a sudden, just, you know, people who are, you know, fleeing conflict can just completely tip the scales in the opposite direction and cause a shock, you know, and all of a sudden the issue of migration in Lebanon has become also on top of the local agenda, despite there already being a laundry list of things which have affected Lebanese significantly well before the migration happened. But because these are non-Lebanese or foreigners. So then you start thinking about the bigger picture of migration in like Europe, for example, and elsewhere. But Lebanon is just an interesting case because it's a small country, but at the same time, it's very similar.
We've seen this a lot in the news, the sort of impact on reporters and journalists more generally, with different conflicts that have been happening around the world, but also beyond conflicts as well. Journalists put their lives on the line when they're reporting from conditions of war, places where there are conflicts happening, but also otherwise. There are all kinds of challenges that journalists are facing these days, right? I mean, even beyond the dangers to their lives, there's also dangers to their professions and so on. And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but what do you think in your experience, again, what have been some of the challenges of being a reporter in this time of conflict and displacement?
There were certain times, I think, in my career where you know, you have to obviously, as a journalist, report purely based on that. And even if you're affected one way or another by that, or someone dear to you is, you have to find a way to compartmentalize that, right? And obviously right now with the war in Gaza, you know, we have colleagues there, you know, and they're doing such an incredible job. And of course, you know, there were several journalists who were killed in southern Lebanon. You know, some of them, you know, we knew very well, very good friends, or severely wounded. And so obviously, you know, no matter how prepared journalists are for these kinds of things, right, what they do, like sort of the hostile environment training, and they have good equipment, these things are not sort of like these magic wands that can save you from these kinds of situations. And obviously elsewhere, you know, you want to make, you know, there's also this sort of thing about where you want to report everything you possibly can, but there's also possible security risks in other aspects of, well, you know, depending on the place where you're reporting, for example, or something like that. But also, I think as well, it's not just about the journalist as well. It's also about the people who you're writing about, the people who you're interviewing as well, because they're also often people who are at risk. And you want to make sure that while you're getting all your information for the story, you don't want to harm people in the process of doing that. So it's a very delicate balance. It requires a lot of critical thinking and patience and discipline and humanity. And there's always a way of doing it, you know. I think something that's nice about being at a large news institution is that there's a lot of experienced reporters who you could get advice from. Whereas when you were sort of on your own as a reporter, especially when you're younger, you know, there's a risk of making some critical mistakes which could harm you or sometimes people around you. And this is something I think, you know, really important, that it's not just about, you know, just chasing the story at any cost. It's also about sometimes you might get an amazing story if it's gonna possibly end your life. It's 99.999%, in my opinion, is not worth it. But that's how I roll personally.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's been interesting to sort of get this perspective, you know, as a journalist on the podcast, because as you pointed out, that, you know, you are on the front lines of getting these stories, and there's so much risk in that process. And it's important to sort of understand, you know, what that experience is to get those different stories, because it's a different process for journalists versus academics or even people who are policymakers and so on. So thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. It's been really interesting to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was an interesting intellectual exercise for me to have, after spending so many months just sort of on the grind, following the story every single day. But yeah, no, it was a pleasure.